Welcome to WISO Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Matthew Goodman and the Antioch Writers Workshop. We'll also round out the show with some Halloween horror stories. Stay tuned for that up first. Dayton resident Sarah Jane Whitlock was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer in October of 2010. Since her diagnosis, Sarah Jane has worked to raise awareness about lung cancer. She joins us in the studio this morning. Sarah, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us, Suzanne Albers, event organizer for Dayton Free to Breathe. It's a 5K and 1 mile run, walk, and rally coming up on November 5th. We're going to talk about that. Suzanne, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Sarah, why don't you just give us a little bit of your background and tell us your story?
Well, I noticed a knot in, above my collarbone back in October of 2010, and I am a nurse practitioner, so I knew that was kind of an odd place for a lymph node to come up. And so after watching it for about a week, I went to my primary care physician who ordered a chest x-ray. And other than that lymph node, I had no symptoms. I had no cough. I had no weight loss, not sweats, none of the kind of classic symptoms that people sometimes associate with lung cancer. I just had this little lymph node that wouldn't go away. And so he ordered a chest x-ray, which showed that I had a mass in my right upper lobe of my lung. So for the next week, I had more tests and more tests and more tests. And at the end of all of that, we knew that I had stage 4 lung cancer, which is the stages go from 1 to 4. So I was, had the worst one. But I was lucky that I had no distant metastasis, which means that it was kind of confined to my chest area and my abdomen. I didn't have anything in my bones or my brain or any of the places that lung cancer likes to go to.
And is that lack of symptoms usual for a disease that has progressed to that stage?
Well, unfortunately, it's not all that uncommon in lung cancer. Only about 16% of them are caught before they're stage 4 because there tends to be not a lot of symptoms going on, or there are symptoms that people can easily ignore. I've got a cough, but it's not a terrible cough. It's just kind of nagging, and, they just put off going to the doctor for something like that. I was fortunate. I mean, I knew because of my background that it was a little odd to have this lymph node come up.
And let's talk a little bit about how your family dealt with this.
Well, we were all shocked, to say the least. I mean, I've never smoked. As far as we knew, I'd never been exposed to any sort of chemical or radon or anything like that. We had bought a house about a year and a half before, and it had been checked. And so there was no reason for me to have lung cancer that we could come up with. So we were really, really shocked. But soon after that, you kind of get over the initial, devastation of that. And everybody just kind of rallied around, and my family and my community. And so overall, while the past year has certainly held its challenges, it's also been a really good year for my family.
Can we talk about the treatment that you went through?
Sure. My initial treatment was a 3-drug cocktail of some pretty hardcore things. I had a drug called cisplatin, another one called Taxol, and another one called Avastin. And I got all of those over about 6 hours once every 3 weeks. And I did that for 6 treatments. I had a really good response with everything. All the cancer in my lungs went away. My abdomen proved to be a little bit more stubborn. Because I did have good success, they went ahead and did 6 weeks of radiation, and that was Monday through Friday for 6 weeks. And then we decided to go after the nodes in my abdomen that were being a little difficult to see if we could do some more genetic testing on those. So I had an operation at the beginning of the summer. After I healed up from that, I started a new treatment with a drug called Alimta. And I've had 4 treatments of that. That's every 3 weeks also, but it only takes about 15 minutes. And the side effects are much, much, much less than the initial treatment. So, and I'm doing very well. The abdominal nodes have responded wonderfully, and I'm they're not going to ever say I'm in remission or that I'm cured, but I'm on a slow simmer is what they've chosen to call it.
So you're also working towards awareness towards lung cancer and the issues surrounding it. How did you begin that journey?
Well, right after I was diagnosed, maybe like 3 weeks, we had a friend who forwarded an email to us about a little blurb she had seen in the paper about the Free to Breathe event. And my husband and I decided that we would just throw it out there and see if any of our friends wanted to participate and see if we could raise a little bit of money. Honestly, we thought maybe we'd raise $500 and we'd call it good. I have a blog that I write on several times a week, and we thought we'd put it out there on that and just see what happened. And this was about 5 days before the event, and it was quite amazing. I think at the end we raised a little over $8,000 within that time, and had about 60 participants, just with our little group, and it was a great experience.
Well, great. Let's talk to Suzanne Albers, event organizer for Dayton Free to Breathe. And Suzanne, were you involved at the time that Sarah initially raised these funds?
Thankfully, yes, I was. This will be my fourth year, which is the fourth annual Free to Breathe here in the Dayton area. Sarah's team, another one of our friends has called her the sleeper team because her team was vying for our free lunch that we give out to the team that makes the most money to help our cause. And Team Sarah Jane came in at the very last minute and did raise over $8,000, brought in over 60 participants. And I got to tell you, our first year, just 3 years ago, the whole event only made $5,000. So she brought in energy. As you can see, she's brought in enthusiasm. She has a great outlook on life. And we continue to do what we do for people like Sarah Jane. Now, the real issue we have isn't the startup money, Jerry. It is getting the word out that lung cancer is the most deadly cancer out there. Lung cancer kills more patients or more people than colon, breast, and prostate combined. And as Sarah Jane had mentioned, there aren't a lot of symptoms, and you picked up on that very, very quickly. I know the month of October, we see a lot of pink out there for breast cancer, but does anybody know what the lung cancer awareness color is?
I don't, and
you
I'm
don't.
Ashamed.
No. It's clear, as you can see. Clear. You can't see the symptoms. You can't feel it. Now, Sarah Jane was lucky, unlucky to feel the lymph node that came up over her collarbone, but you can't see into the lungs. There are little nerve endings there. So we would give clear shirts to everybody, but that probably wouldn't go over very well. So you have to trust me on that. But a lot of people don't realize the numbers of lung cancer and who it affects. 15% of all lung cancer patients have never smoked. 40% of all lung cancer patients did smoke at one time, but maybe have given it up in the past, maybe 20, 30 years ago, maybe 3 years ago. They saw that maybe there was a better option. And about 45% of all lung cancer patients are current smokers. But whereas lung cancer can be considered a smoker's disease, at least half the patients are not or haven't smoked in a long time. And that's what the word we're really trying to get out is the Free to Breathe event is trying to let people know that lung cancer can affect anybody who has a set of lungs, and also trying to let people know that the funding for research and diagnosis and treatment is very, very low.
So let's talk about the details on mm-hmm. this year's event, and let's hear from both of you. Tell us what's going on. It is on November 5th.
Saturday morning, November 5th. We're hoping for some bright sunshine. The 5K run or walk and the 1 mile run or walk will start at Centerville High School at 9 o'clock in the morning. We will have a little rally about 8:45 as we're walking out to the starting line to kind of discuss some facts, figures about lung cancer. And then the race will start. You can run it, you can walk it, you can do cartwheels through it. I really don't care. We just want to get people out there to see what's going on and to raise the awareness. We're hoping some families come out with some younger kids. We've opened up the age group awards at the younger levels, so hopefully more kids will get some nice medals to bring home and to motivate them to maybe learn a little bit more about what's going on out there with lung cancer. We've had some great sponsors who have given us a lot of prizes for door prizes, a lot of items for a silent auction to help raise some money. Some samples are going out there, some different food items. So hopefully it'll be a nice event for a lot of people to attend.
Sarah, what about how your diagnosis has changed you personally as far as outlook or perception of things?
Well, I tell everybody that a big dose of clarity is a really good thing. There were when I look back on where I was, you know, the end of the summer, first of fall of that 2010, there were some things, you know, within with work or with family that was kind of bugging me, and you can get yourself all spun up about that. And then when something like this happens, you just all of a sudden it makes a whole lot of things go away. A lot of things fall away that don't matter. For me personally, it has tested my faith in a way that it had not been tested before. And thankfully, I found that it was the solid foundation that I could rest on. That's been a wonderful comfort to both me and my family. I think it's protected us from a lot of bitterness and anger. We've chosen to continue to live joyfully in the face of this. And that does not mean that we don't have days that are unspeakably sad. I have two girls that are just turned 13 and will soon turn 10. I look at their faces. Some days that's difficult to think what might lie ahead for us, but we are realistically optimistic is what we like to say. And we are hopeful that with further research, that I'll be around for a long time. And you know, I'm not the only one. My story is my story, but I'm certainly not the only one that's fighting this disease. And so we're thankful for all that people like Suzanne do to help find a cure for this.
Ladies, any final thoughts?
I do have one. If you're listening to this right now and you think what you do doesn't make a difference, I can tell you, from example of Sarah Jane, one person can make a difference in this fight. And she, starting alone in this event, has brought on so many people. And with those people came a lot of dollars. And with those dollars is coming more research for earlier detection, diagnosis, and treatment of lung cancer. All this has gone to the Free to Breathe and then is going back out into the community. But if you're thinking you can't make a difference, truly one person can. And if you can't come to the event, you can still go to the website of freetobreathe.org. You can donate money to the organization that way. You can send the email to a friend and say, hey, you live over in this area. There's going to be an event. Stop out. We're hoping for 700 people at our event, which is a big jump for us. And hopefully next year we'll be up to 1,400, and we're not going to stop. People like Sarah Jane and other people with lung cancer deserve more than what they're getting right now. And we hope to change that.
Dayton resident Sarah Jane Whitlock was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer in October of 2010. Suzanne Albers is the event organizer of the Dayton Free to Breathe 5K and 1 mile run, walk, and rally coming up November 5th. Ladies, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Continuing our series of faculty readings from this summer's Antioch Writers Workshop, Matthew Goodman's essays, articles, and short stories have appeared in many publications, including the Harvard Review and Village Voice. Here, he reads from his forthcoming book, Ahead of Time, Nellie Bly and Elizabeth Bislint's History Making Race Around the World.
So I'm going to read a section, a brief section, that is about Elizabeth Bislint, going on a fast mail train across the country from New York to San Francisco. She manages to get onto this experimental fast mail train that has never gone before, that if it can get from New York to San Francisco in 4 days, it's going to win a contract of $750,000. So she's on this train along with reporters and railroad officials, and nobody else is on the train. To pass the time, some of the men played whist in the general manager's private car. One of the passengers brought a Winchester rifle out to the platform of the rear car and took shots at coyotes and grouse. It was possible to stand on the platform and see all the way to the horizon in any direction. The air shone with a luminous clarity that Elizabeth Bislint did not recognize from the coastal cities south and north in which she had lived. Here was the frontier she had read about in childhood stories of pioneer families. It was a windswept, empty place. They rode through vast plains the color of ash. The only water was in feebly trickling streams around which no greenery grew. Spavined horses took what little sustenance they could from the barren upland meadows. From time to time, the train passed an isolated settlement. usually little more than a few rickety cabins made of rough, unpainted boards. The cabins always tightly shut up and to all indications empty, as though the occupants had fled in advance of an invading army. Only once did she ever see any signs of human habitation around those silent, lonely homes, and that was a tiny pair of light brown wool trousers, butternut trousers as they were then called, fluttering on a clothesline. As the train continued west, the land grew, if possible, even drearier. To Bisland, it began to resemble a kind of prehistoric Sodom sown with salt. There was, she thought, something brutal and hideous in the doom laid upon this unhappy country, as of a Prometheus chained to his mountaintops, its blood dry to dust in its veins, and lifting a scarred face of gray despair to the rainless sky. Near Wyoming, the train began a long ascent into the mountains. The train stopped at various stations along the way to pick up and distribute bags of mail and to change engines and crews. Whenever the stop was long enough, Bisland made time to walk around for a few minutes, filling her lungs with the cold air and shaking out her limbs to get the blood moving. The mountain air brought a strange exhilaration, a sense of impending good fortune. "It is," said one of the reporters, "like sublimated champagne." By nightfall, the train was approaching the Utah Territory. The stars here were not the softly glowing planets she remembered from her girlhood in Louisiana. Here they shone as keen and brilliant as swords. Much of the earlier delay had been made up in crossing Wyoming, but at Evanston, near the Utah border, the train was still 28 minutes behind schedule. $750,000 hung on their timely arrival in Ogden. At Evanston, a new, more powerful engine was brought on, as was a new engineer. Bill Downing was a mountain engineer, a large, bluff Irishman apparently blessed or cursed with a complete absence of fear. Among railroad people, he was known as Cyclone Bill. He understood that it was his business to get to Ogden on time, and he meant to do it. "It is 76 miles to Ogden," he told one of the reporters, "and I will not be happy until I make it in 72 minutes. That kind of speed was impossible down Weber Canyon, the reporter said, but Downing was resolute. He would, he announced with a disarming cheerfulness as he climbed into the cab, "get us to Ogden or hell on time." Several times during the course of that ride, Bisland later reported, the betting stood 10 to 1 on Hades. At precisely 12:55 a.m., Cyclone Bill pulled out the throttle and the train lurched into motion. Using every pound of steam the engine could handle, the train climbed the eastern slope of the Wasatch Mountain Range, its speed increasing as it neared the summit, where it paused momentarily and then, with a stomach-lurching plunge, began its race downhill. The train careened wildly around the mountain passes, swept across plateaus, shot through tunnel after tunnel, going faster and faster. Still, the engineer did not ease up on the throttle. The local superintendent for the railway mail service, James E. White, tried to joke that Downing was straightening out all the curves on the line, but there was no laughter in the car. Someone murmured that it would be a terrible thing to run off the track. No one said anything to that. Derailments happened more often than anyone in the car cared to think about, and particularly at high rates of speed. An isolated mountain pass late at night, it didn't need saying, would be the worst possible place to derail. To Elizabeth Bisland, the train felt like a runaway horse. One of the reporters compared it to some insane monster striving to free himself. Its roar reverberated like a cannonade off the rocky sides of the canyon. At Devil's Gate, where the track was not as crooked, the train seemed impossibly to pick up speed. The car rocked side to side like a ship in a storm, and some of the passengers actually became seasick, turning in their urgency to the nearby cuspidors. The warm, crowded car took on an unpleasant aroma. One man began to writhe on the floor in terror and was handed a flask of brandy to calm himself. From the rear platform of the car, the passengers could see a shower of sparks trailing behind them. The tracks looked like two lines of fire in the night. The telegraph poles, Bisland wrote, reeled backwards from our course and the land fled from under us with horrible nightmare weirdness. She was not sick, but she could feel her nerves beginning to give way. Everyone sitting down held tight to the armrests. Those who had mistakenly imagined they might sleep clutched the sides of their berths to keep from falling out. The train passed into the longest tunnel on the road, more than 700 feet cut out of hard red clay and sandstone. For long seconds, the blackness outside the windows seemed to grow still blacker. Just beyond the tunnel, the approach was the approach to Echo Canyon, where the declivity was 250 feet per mile and the road was said to be as crooked as a ram's horn. Here the tracks hugged close to the hillsides, running along a narrow strip of earth high above the canyon. As the hardier among the passengers gazed down at the sheer drop, James White recalled years later, a feeling of awe came over us like that which takes possession of brave men who look upon death in violent forms from great heights or amidst horrible surroundings. They could hear the steel wheels grinding on the curves. Behind them, the double stream of fire was almost continuous. White got up to check the speed indicator that had been installed in the car and gasped at what he read there. Incredibly, a mile through Echo Canyon had been run in 52 seconds. Ahead lay an even more treacherous bit of road, the reverse loop at Antelope Gap. The train hit the first curve at full speed, and as it did, one side of the car was lifted into the air so that only one set of wheels still clung to the tracks. There was an awful moment of suspense, and then the car managed to right itself, the wheels landing down with a bump before the train hit the reverse turn and the other set of wheels went up. Finally, General Manager Edward Dickinson could take no more. "Let the schedule go," he shouted to C.E. Brown, the Union Pacific press agent. "Pull the bell rope, Brown, then run forward and tell Downing to stop this if he wants us to reach Ogden alive." Brown passed the orders up to the engineer, but Bill Downing, checking his watch, replied that he regretted he could not oblige them. When that word came back, Dickinson sprang to his feet, ran to the rear platform of the car, and pulled the brake with all his might. The speed began to slacken. Still, the fast mail train arrived at Ogden on schedule. The final 76 miles had been covered in 65 minutes, the shortest time ever recorded on that stretch of road. Having made good on his promise, Cyclone Bill Downing dismounted from his cab, casually remarking that these night rides were prone to give a man a cold. He passed through the swinging doors of a bar on the corner and was not seen again.
This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. To finish out our program, we've got three terrifying tales to tell. They were part of the Kaleidoscope special this past Wednesday and feature local horror hosts on our public access airwaves, Baron Von Porkchop, Dr. Freak, and Louis and L. Lermo.
Ah, hello, piggies. This is Baron Von Porkchop from the Terrifying Tales of the Macabre. And do I have a terrifying tale for you tonight? My story tonight for you, little piggies, is Undying Love. A farmer had a daughter who he cared for more than anything in this world. She fell in love with a farmhand named Mike Ritchie. But the farmer did not think that Mike was good enough for his daughter. To keep them apart, he sent her to live with her uncle on the other side of the country. Soon after she left, Mike got very ill, and he started wasting away, and for many days he stayed ill. And everyone said Mike was sick from a broken heart. The farmer felt so guilty about Mike's illness that he could not tell his daughter what had happened to Mike. She continued to think about Mike and her life they might have had together. One night, many weeks later, there was a knock on her door. When the girl opened the door, Mike was standing there. "Your father sent for you," he said. "I came on his best horse." "Is there anything wrong?" she asked. "I don't know," he said. She packed a few things, and then they left. She rode behind him, clinging to his waist. Soon he complained of a headache. "It aches something terrible," he told her. She put her hand on his forehead. "Why, you're as cold as clay," she said. "I hope you are not ill." And she wrapped a handkerchief around his head. They traveled so swiftly that in just a few hours, they reached her father's farm. The girl quickly dismounted and knocked on the door. Her father was startled to see her. "Did you not send for me?" she asked. He said, "No, I did not." She turned to Mike, but he was gone, and so was the horse. They went to the stable to look for them. The horse was there. It was covered with sweat and trembling with fear, but there was no sign of Mike. Terrified, her father told her the truth about Mike's death. Yes, Mike had died several weeks before. So they quickly went to Mike's parents' house. They decided to open up his grave. The corpse was in his coffin, but around its head, they found the girl's handkerchief. That wasn't that a terrifying tale? Oh, piggies, I hope you're not too afraid.
Hello, I'm Dr. Freak from Cult Theater. This is Whistling in the Dark. It was late at night. Tommy was lying in bed. He was scared because he knew something lived in his closet. Every night when he would turn off the lights, he would hop into bed quickly for fear something would grab his feet. He would start to hear the scratching and clawing in his closet door. Some nights, it would even start to slowly open and he'd hear the pattering of these clawed feet on his hardwood floor. One night, the sound got so close to his bed, it was basically next to him. Finally, he screamed out, "Mom!" His mother came into the room. He was breathing heavily. He had cold sweat on his forehead. His mother told him to calm down, that everything would be okay, and that if things got too scary in the room late at night, he could just whistle a happy song and everything would be okay. She got up off the bed, turned off the light, and closed the door. The little boy sat there for a moment in the dark. The clawing started yet again. The door slowly opened. The feet started to move across his hardwood floor. He was panicking, but he listened to his mother's advice and began to whistle. He tried to make up a happy tune as quick as he could in his mind. Suddenly, he felt a claw leaning on his neck and a scary, disgusting mouth going up against his ears, whispering, "Thank you for whistling. I don't know how I would have ever found you in this dark room if you hadn't."
Tag, You're It, by Louise Allen Bean Lerma. These two young friends are laughing and playing with each other on a swing set, trying to swing higher than the other one. They see it's getting late. "My mom told me there's a playground monster that will come out after dark, and it'll get us if we're not out of here."
"No, there isn't. There's no monster out here."
"Yes, there is. I've seen it around behind here. We have to go home. Come on."
"No, there isn't. I'm going to stay here a little longer. You're full of it."
"Yes, there really is a monster. Four people have seen it, too. I think the janitor has set up a trap to catch it. So if that isn't real, then I don't know what is. You better come with me. Don't stay here, because the monster loves to come to you if you're all alone. And it loves to play games with you, but not the games that you want to play. Scary games."
"Well, I'm going to stay and play here and have the playground all to myself. I'm going to have lots of fun, and I'll see you tomorrow."
"I hope so." The friend who stays there sees the swing start to swing again, and the merry-go-round starts to spin on its own, faster and then faster. He gets down off his swing and says aloud,
"That's funny. I don't see anyone in the park."
He thinks that it's his friend playing some trick, so he yells out,
"Hey, I thought you were going home. Is this some kind of joke?"
But there's no return answer, so he starts to walk over, convinced it's his friend. All of a sudden, a big black mass turns into a 10-foot-tall monster beast with white, sharp teeth, sharp as a shark's, and covered in brown and dark, dingy hair. There's blood on its hands, and it lets out a growl. The little boy doesn't think, so instinctively turns around and hauls butt. with the fastest gait that he can. He runs across the playground. Only to his dismay, the giant monster is close behind. He goes over to the carousel, and the monster's behind him. He runs over to the swings, and the monster is following. Hoping that he doesn't get caught on the swings, he still chases around and around, trying to trap the monster. He runs past the sandbox, shaking with agonizing fear at being found. He dives under the leaves and stays as still as he can. But then he hears footsteps coming closer and closer. He gets curious and opens one eye and spies out, and then feels a grab on his shoulder. Tag, you're it. Happy Halloween.
Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. I'm afraid that's it for this week's edition of Why So Weekend. Thanks to all of our guests. Coming up next on member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, The Book Nook.